Linda Greenhouse did a good job in setting the stage for this discussion. When I stepped down a year ago, the start of February, a year ago, I decided that I'd better get busy and try to do something about the attacks on judges in my new private capacity. It seemed to me that we were seeing an enormous increase in the rhetoric in the halls of Congress, in the halls of state legislatures, and among the public generally, addressing judicial activity that was usually described as activist judges, godless secular humanists trying to impose their will on the rest of us. I didn't quite recognize who they were talking about there, but that seems to be the rhetoric. And I've lived a long time now, and I can remember, even in my lifetime, some other periods when there was a lot of unhappiness with judges. I grew up on a cattle ranch in a remote part of Arizona and New Mexico, and on that little highway between Duncan, Arizona, and Lordsburg, New Mexico, was a big sign, "Impeach Earl Warren," it said. And we drove past that for a couple of years, and nothing came of that. We had, of course, Franklin Roosevelt a few years earlier, and he was extremely unhappy with the courts, particularly the U.S. Supreme Court, because he had some legislation to try to get the U.S. out of its depression. And some of those bills came before the court and were struck down by the court as unconstitutional. And this was very distressing to that president. And he developed his plan whereby every time a member of the Supreme Court turned 70, the president could appoint an additional new justice. Well, of course, six of the justices were over 70 at the time. And his proposal came very close to passage. Quite close, too close for comfort. But at the end of the day, it didn't, and we remember the switch in time that saved nine when one of the justices who had been a vote on some of the cases striking down the legislation voted the other way on a new case, and that seemed to ease the pain a little bit, and we went on as before. But I think the rhetoric we've heard recently is cause for alarm and concern. And Linda Greenhouse mentioned some of the provisions offered in Congress to control judges in some fashion, jurisdiction stripping proposals, and they aren't new. And of course, Congress does have the right to control the jurisdiction of federal courts. And luckily, they've never exercised it fully. And given the courts more to do, federal judges think we already have too much to do. So that's okay. But it's a worry when they take selective issues in Congress and say, well, if it's something to do with the Pledge of Allegiance or something to do with this or that, we won't let the courts deal with it. That's a different kind of approach that I think should be of concern to everyone. You probably remember the Terry Schiavo case in Florida. And the Florida courts considered that tragic situation and ultimately said that the woman's husband had the right to authorize the doctors to remove her feeding tubes because she was thought by her doctors to be brain dead. Now, that decision was viewed with alarm by some members of Congress, who passed a bill for that one case only to require the federal courts to consider the case. That was highly unusual to take one case from the state courts and say the federal courts must review it. Well, the federal courts did review it and ultimately did not find that the Florida state courts had committed an error. And when the federal courts had finished with their review, then there were demands by some in Congress for mass impeachment of the federal judges who had carried out their duty to review the case. I mean, this is not the way we expect our court system to be operating in this country. And Linda mentioned Chief Justice Chaudhry in Pakistan. I attended a conference in Belfast last summer on children and youth, and Chief Justice Chaudhry was one of the people participating in that conference, and I got to know him a little bit and was very interested in what he had to say. He gave some good presentations, and it was fascinating for me to meet and discuss some of these issues with a Muslim Chief Justice and get his views on things. I thought he was very impressive, to tell you the truth. I kept a copy of one of his speeches, and I was distressed to see that he was summarily dismissed. We like to think in our country that we're immune from actions like that. And I know as I traveled around the world, in years past, I always had kind of a smug feeling that, well, we're different in America. We have a legal system, a rule of law that really protects us, and I feel safer in America than I do in other countries. Well, I'm not sure how safe we are in the present circumstances and in the present unhappiness with our state of the judiciary. And it is not that judges are always right, always correct. They aren't, of course. That's why we have a system of appellate review. So if a trial judge decides something, there can be an appeal to a court of appeals. And in most states, you can go on then to the state Supreme Court with some issue of alleged error. There are means for correction. Now, it's a little hard to correct a U.S. Supreme Court decision. There's no immediate appeal from that. But the Supreme Court decides relatively few issues, and I think relatively small numbers of those would be the kind that would cause general concern, although some do, of course. But we're celebrating this year the 400th birthday of the founding of Jamestown, the first English, permanent English settlement in this country. And when you look back on what that meant to this country, it brought both bad and good. Those settlers died in large numbers. Only about 10% of them survived. And they ended up finally surviving by importing tobacco plants from the Caribbean and growing tobacco. I'm not sure that was great for the world's health, but that's what they did to make money, and they did that successfully because they didn't find gold and they didn't find a route to the Pacific Ocean as they had intended to do. And to grow the tobacco, they brought in some slaves. Well, that didn't do our country much good in the long run. It took about 350 years to work on the problems of that, and we're not finished yet, I dare say. So it's not all positive remembrances that we have. But the one thing that the settlers in Jamestown brought with them that has lasted and has been the most significant is the concept of the British legal system, the rule of law, the notion that even the king is subject to the law. 400 years before the settlement of Jamestown, King John signed the Magna Carta. Now that was pretty significant, and the people who drafted the Virginia Charter, it was supposed to be a money-making business, you know, were lawyers, barristers from the Middle Temple in London. And a group of those barristers got together and drafted the charter and included within it were directions that the colonists were going to take with them the British common law and the British legal system. And that did last. And that is so important to us. It really matters. And I think it matters to every one of us that we try to protect the independence of our nation's courts, state and federal. It really matters. And what does judicial independence mean? It doesn't mean that any judge is free to make any crazy decision they want to make. Every judge, state or federal, takes the same oath of office. You raise your hand and swear that you will uphold the Constitution and laws of the United States, so help me God. Now that's what you promised to do. So judges aren't free to just do anything they want. But what judicial independence means is that the other two branches of government are not free to take action against judges for their judicial acts. It means that Congress can't undertake to punish a judge or a group of judges for particular decisions that they've reached, and the same with the executive. That's the concept, and it's a very, very important concept. As we all know from high school civics, which no longer is a requirement, by the way, to learn, we have three branches of government. Now, I suppose you've all seen the poll. Now, Annenberg, is Kathleen Jameson here today, I hope? The Annenberg Foundation took some very interesting polls, and they learned that a majority of young people in this country today can name the Three Stooges, but not the three branches of government. Does that give you any confidence? And it shows that more people vote for an American idol than for President of the United States. I mean, we're in pretty bad shape here, if you want to know. And so I think that it bears remembering what some of the framers of the Constitution had to say about judicial independence. The father of the Constitution, James Madison, said, an independent judiciary is an impenetrable bulwark against every assumption of power in the legislative or executive. Well, impenetrable may be putting it a little strongly, but the basic idea is sound. If you believe, as I do, that the courts are important guardians of constitutionally guaranteed freedoms in our common law system, you know the system breaks down without judicial independence. And it is hard to define. But remember Potter Stewart, who knew pornography when he saw it, but he couldn't define it? Well, I think I know judicial independence when I see it. And we're seeing attacks on it today. And the fact is that the main check that the judicial branch has on the others is the power to declare statutes or executive acts unconstitutional. Sometimes courts can check the political branches in a softer way just by interpreting a statute in light of constitutional values, or by ruling that a regulation or an executive act is not authorized by statute. But whatever courts do, they have the power to make the president or Congress, the executive or the legislative branch, really, really angry. And I guess if the courts never made them angry, we better be worried, because that seems to be the role that the framers had in mind when they drafted the Constitution. And judicial independence doesn't happen all by itself. Our great Chief Justice, John Marshall, spent over 30 years trying to create a climate in this country of respect and trust in the judicial branch. And he did a pretty good job. And for the most part, the other branches of government have by and large, accepted decisions of the courts and enforced them, although sometimes they didn't. We had Andrew Jackson, of course, in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in Worcester versus Georgia, the case that said Georgia couldn't oust all Indians from the state of Georgia and take the land. And he is, the president, Jackson, is reported to have said, well, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it, knowing, of course, that he couldn't. Well, creating the culture of respect for the work of the judicial branch is very important to all of us, and it's what we have tried to persuade the newly forming countries in Eastern Europe to adopt as part of their newly formed states. And I don't think you can just assume that courts can protect themselves. They can't. And that's why it is so important that the citizens generally understand what the meaning of judicial independence is and the role of the citizen in trying to see to it that we don't lose it. And I welcome today's discussion. I welcome your participation. We have real problems at the state level, and I've been a state court judge, so we're going to talk about that more today. We've got Chief Justice Judith Kaye from New York, and we have Professor Jay here, who will have a lot to say about that. And I welcome the chance to participate in the discussion and the questions. Thank you.